Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Sadhu. Well, welcome to you all, and Happy New Year. Chinese, Tibetan, and Anglo. Hanukkah too is all there. And do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints you wanted to bring up first?
Yeah, I've heard that term before, but you used it yesterday. Stream entry.
That's when the mind has pierced the illusion of a permanent self. There is self, but there is no permanent self. This is the Buddhist traditional teaching. There is not an inherent identity. Does that make sense to you? Do you know what that means? Okay. We generally tend to believe that there is a subject and an object. The subject is me and the object is whatever it is that I'm looking at. Do you think that's true? Generally speaking, I'm listening to you. Yeah. I hear you. I understand what you're saying. Ta da da da. It's all self-reference from what I hear. This is what. Right? And because that is the perceptive, the way that we perceive, especially in the material world, subject and object, a separateness, we actually believe that that is real. We actually believe that a separate self is a reality. Do you think that's true?
Sure.
At some point or other, if one is involved in a path of inquiry, depth inquiry, or meditation, at some point or another, the mind pierces that. It is an illusion. If there is a permanent self or soul, then that would mean that you would be unchanging. Do you think that's true?
Yeah.
Are you unchanging?
No.
And so even though in the experience of your own life, you have noticed that you changed, say, from the time you were 2 years old, have you changed since you were 2 years old?
Yeah.
All along, at various times in your life, you have felt like an I. And when you feel like an I, you also feel like I have never changed. I know this is true. I always thought this. Have you ever said that? I've always believed this. Have you ever said that? Anybody in this room not said that? I know this is true. I always believe this. Or, you know, I don't like such and such. Any of you not said that? Or I like such and such? And there is a feeling like that's really who I is. There's an identification with that, isn't there? There's a strong feeling about that. And when you like something and then you find out that actually when you really taste it or smell it or touch it or whatever, you don't like it, it's a shock, isn't it? Has that ever happened to you? Or when you think something is here and then suddenly it's here, it's a shock. Can you recall moments when that's happened? Like you're stepping off a curb and then you find out there's no curb.
Mm-hmm.
There's that shock. The big shock is to the sense of self. That your sense of self just shifts and you're aware suddenly of the gap. That the sense of self is actually a habit. It's a story we tell by connecting the dots. Okay, this experience is one that I want to work with. This one I don't, this one I do, this one I do, this one I don't, this one I do, this one I do, this one I don't. Well, this is what I have done today. And there are billions of things that I have done that I don't even remember. The ones I remember are the ones of the story of myself that I happen to believe in for that moment. Do you think this is true? Do you have a set story about your life?
You want to hear it?
Do you know anyone who doesn't? Do you believe your set story? Oh, now this is different grounds altogether. Have you ever talked about an experience? Do you have brothers and sisters? How many of you in this room do not have brothers and sisters? Okay, so this will be a little more difficult for you, but you have. Do you have other family members that have shared experiences? So when you hear one of your family members, like one of your siblings, describing an experience, is it the same as you remember it? Who's right? Do you feel very strongly about the right? My father was born in Poland. My sister's father was born in Germany. Same man, same picture, same name, same father and mother. She was 4 years older than me. I was born in 1939. Does that date mean anything to any of you? What? 1939 was the year Canada joined the Second World War. My father was born in Poland. Her father was born in Germany. She's 4 years older than me. My father's actual village in which he was born is in Poland. Very small village was in Poland when he was born, in the Republic of Poland. But the registry was 3 miles away, which happened to be in Germany. My sister is talking to someone about her father who was born, and she says, well, you know, be careful what you say about Germans, eh? Because my father was German. Was German. Germish. And I said, no, he was Polish. Why? Because that's the story that goes with the I, whose father was there when I was born in 1939. Do you know how many thousands of stories like that you have? Half of them you will never know you're carrying about what is real and what is valid and what isn't and what is. Do you know that as you start to get older, you lose control of those stories? So you forget exactly the dates, so you just start applying any name. Isn't that just disgusting? Do you know that every one of us has a career choice, senility? Do you have your wardrobe for it ready? Have you got your hearing aids, your cane, your support hose? Good man. He's the only one who's appropriately dressed. He sprained his ankle 2 days ago, so now he has his support hose. It's his bandage around his...
Testing the waters.
Is it the changing nature then that makes it not real, or I mean, is it just this? This, like you said, there's an illusion that it's fixed. But say, I was thinking something more like on a more personal level. Like say, you know, I can think, well, you know, this is me sitting here.
It is a me. Yes, there is a me, but it's not the me.
Right.
There is not a fixed, inherent, fixed identity.
Right.
There is continuously a sense of self. There is continuously a separating out and a naming process occurring, and then it is continuously there is a dissolution back. So it's continuously moving from being to knowing to being to knowing to being. Being is a state of at-one-ment, knowing is a state of naming the at-one-ment. At the point of stream, so you're all following me for all this, and you can all identify this in your own lives?
Sorry,
no? Because I have explained it well enough already, okay? So then, at the point of stream entry, which was the question, right? There is a conscious full awareness of moving into that gap between the eyes, between the sense of self. Moving into that gap, staying there, experiencing it, not having a fear reaction, not trying to cover it up, not grasping for anything else, and knowing the truth of that. Knowing the mind that is not identified by an inherent self. From that moment on, there one is no longer subject to superstition. One is no longer caught by hope and fear, because hope and fear always revolves around the belief in an I that has to be made safe. If there's no I, you don't have to worry about being safe. So the Buddha said, "Oh, you who toil and sweat under the heel of a terrible master, I have good news for you. Your terrible master does not exist. How much we labor for I. I like this. I don't like that. But that's what stream entry, number one thing it means, is that there is a clear conscious perception that allows one to pierce the illusion of a permanent self. And it is no longer possible anymore to believe in a permanent self or a permanent identity. Does that answer your question? Does it bring up 20 more?
I think about it. But yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Anybody else have any questions, answers? Yes?
When I was in...
Welcome back.
Yeah. When I was in South Africa, in the Dharma teachings before about a month, were stressing that it's a rare opportunity, that it's rather rare that you reincarnate back as a human, that it's more likely you could reincarnate into an animal and flip back and forth. And I personally don't know what to make of that.
What is the number one about it for you? That's a good English word, you all know that. You've looked it up in the day. No. What's the number one?
I don't know whether that's prevalent.
What is it about the idea that is difficult for you? What don't you like about it?
There are different
just states. Can't go there.
And there are different states of consciousness of each life expression, if I can use that. And what is the teaching value of going back and forth?
Yeah, and that's a wonderful question. There is a book that I highly recommend. I really highly recommend it. Because what you're talking about is, to my mind, the best way to really understand the whole question of reincarnation, which some people say, from a Buddhist point of view, is an optional belief, but I don't think it's optional at all. I think if you really start examining, only that's the only possible understanding. But that's not usually what people say when they talk about Buddhism. But a book that deals with probably the most difficult aspect of reincarnation or rebirth to understand. It talks about it from the point of view of there is a Pali word, sankhara, S-A-N-K-H-A-R-A, sankhara, and it generally means formations. It's usually translated as formations into English. That it's not a good translation, it's not a bad translation. The propensities, its developments, its likelihoods, its tendencies, none of those words exactly say what sankhara is. But there is a book that was written by a Jungian therapist who was extremely well trained in the Jungian tradition, and against all of his better judgment, found himself believing in other selves, or previous selves, or other births, from his own experiences and from experiences of the people he worked with. So he has written this book called Other Lives, Other Selves. And he bases the whole book on the only theory he found that seemed to give a plausible explanation was the theory in Buddhism and in Hinduism of sankhara. So for a Western person to have some grasp of what's being talked about here, they will have to understand what is meant by sankhara. And the best explanation I know in English is this book called Other Lives, Other Selves. So first, I strongly recommend that you get it from the library, or, you know, buy a copy and pass it around or whatever. And have any of you actually read it? I've actually recommended it, what, 4 or 5 times now? Any of you actually read it?
I think I have.
Have you?
I'm not quite sure if that's the right title or not, but it sounds...
Yeah.
Or it's something so close, but it's either past lives, past selves, or it's this one.
Yeah, it's a Jungian
who
wrote it?
Mm-hmm.
Probably it. And what you are talking about when you're talking about sankhara is propensities, seeds of activity looking for a place to happen. If the ground is right and the circumstances are right, those seeds will sprout. We are all seed bags of enormous variety. Do you think that's true? So in one circumstance, this sprouts. In another circumstance, this sprouts. Do you think that's true? There isn't time for all of them to sprout. So depending on circumstances, this sprouts or that sprouts. Can you see that in your own lives? Can you see that certain conditions allow the same seed to sprout in different ways? That, for example, if you were subjected to a lot of emotional pain when you were a child, you probably went through a certain period of time of being quite rebellious and nasty little human being. And then you didn't like that, so you used the same seeds to develop another aspect of your being. Do you think that's true? So the seeds do not predetermine your activity or what you will be. Is that clear? When you're talking about rebirth or reincarnation, you're not talking about destiny. You're talking about propensities. Do you understand that? That's a very important point. It's a very important point. So if one were to take the understanding that there is no inherent self, and yet there is this seed bag of propensities, and at death the bag breaks, then are all the seeds going to be scooped up into the same bag again when a new bag is formed? Some are big, some are small. Some look like rocks. If there's a high wind, a few of them will get blown off. If there's a flood, a few of them will get washed up. And other ones will get collected up with the... Does this make sense to you? This, it is not the self that is reborn. There is always a new self. Every moment, every birth. And I think for Westerners, that's probably the hardest thing to wrap your mind around. And I think it's the hardest thing to wrap your mind around because you feel like you are I. Because you feel like you are an I. To conceive of being other than I is crazy. But if you actually examine the I you were this morning when you got up and the I you are tonight sitting in this room, they're quite different eyes, are they not? Or are you exactly the same? Huh? Are they the same? Are they different? There's a continuum. But it's not the same. There is a continuum. There is always a continuum. What the continuum is the activity, the cause and effect. So in Buddhism, it is not a self that is reborn, it is karma that continues, action that continues, reaping effect and action and effect and so forth. So there is a continuum of consciousness. The woman at the seniors' place at where my mother lives, the woman who is in charge of social activities. She's a lovely woman. She has two sons, one's 7, one's 5. She leads sing songs and goes around and rushes up on people and starts kissing them all over the neck. And, you know, she's quite a wonderful woman. She has this joy with people that is really exceptional, and she cares very much for the people who are there. And that's her whole job, to care for these people. And she loves telling stories about her two children. So she's telling stories about her two sons. They have a pool table. They got a pool table. Because she really likes playing pool. Her oldest son has real problems playing pool. Her youngest son aces the shots. He beats his mother. 5 years old, he beats his mother at pool. She's saying, I don't know what to do about this shot. He stands beside her, this 5-year-old, and he says, well, Mom, you should make it so it angles and hits there and then goes over there and goes over there and then hits that ball. She's saying, how come you know that? He said to her, she's telling this story. She said, because I'm a professional. She says, yeah, you're a professional 5-year-old. Is there anything you had a talent for when you were young that you've forgotten now? I know tokus. Do you have any idea what talents were strong in the consciousness of whoever it was that made you? And when you get off the horse, who's going to get on? What kind of life are you making for someone who's going to get on that horse after you get off? These are interesting questions. Have I taken it in a different direction than you were thinking?
Yeah.
Does it make it a little more playful? The way I've taken it?
Yeah, you see it more as an opportunity for some learning to occur independent of what you think?
There is not a self. There's not a fixed self. Every moment, every lifetime, there is the opportunity to awaken. Some lifetimes, as the saying goes, are more equal than others. Everything's equal. It's an equal opportunity field for awakening, and some are more equal than others. Human is good. Why is human good? Because there's enough suffering to ask a good question, and there's enough calm to get a good answer. It's just a nice mixture, you know? But you have to practice the calm. If you've got the suffering and the question, then you have to practice the calm. Not the frustration, but the calm. If you got the calm, then you need a little frustration. It has to be the right balance of the two. It has to be the stimulation and the calm. It's a balance point. That's the whole thing. It's a balance point. In the human realm, there is that opportunity to have both the calm and the question. Or, according to the Buddha, two liberations are necessary. Liberation of the heart and liberation of the mind. Liberation of the mind is question. Best way to start asking question is when you don't like something. Is that true? Do you ask questions when you like everything? No, you just kind of go, oh, this is nice. I'll see y'all later. When you wake up, you say, who did that? Good question. Good question. There's enough calm, you go to sleep, you have a dream. Good answer. If you're too well asleep, you don't remember the dream. Or, there are two veils that obscure reality. One is conflict of emotion, and the other is fixed or primitive view, limited view. Limited view is like having a father who was born in Germany, so he couldn't possibly have been born in Poland. Or having a father that was born in Poland, so he couldn't possibly have been born in Germany. That's limited view, right? This is the truth. In a relative world, having a fixed view and not seeing it as relative is called primitive view. Conflicting emotion is any state that is not loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, or equanimity. Any state where the heart is in conflict. Those four states, those four emotional states are considered to be boundless. That is to say, without conflict. So a human consciousness has the opportunity to develop calm, that is loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, and question, and clearly understanding the cause and effect, dancing. But in order to do that, there has to be a willingness to let go of duality, self, other. Because you are going to let go of duality somehow or other, whether you choose it or not, because every one of us at some time or other are going to let go of self. It isn't a question of choice. It's a question of the wisdom about considering how you might train yourself to make that an easier thing to do. I would rather not go more into that tonight until you've read that book. Could you get that book and read it? Other Lives, Other Selves. I really recommend it. I've recommended it 3 or 4 times to you now, I think, haven't I?
Mm-hmm.
You have heard this before?
Yes.
It's on tape?
Yeah.
Okay. I've accentuated. Have I underlined it? Have I named? Other Lives, Other Selves. A book that you might... Other Lives and Want to. Other Selves. Read sometime because it's Other Lives, Other Selves. Very interesting. I think you heard me now, huh? It's useful. It's a useful book. Useful book. You can feel your psyche shift from a very fixed view. Now, for some of you, I know that would be shocking, but you could maybe go to see your doctor first, get some Prozac, and then read the book. It will be okay. Or go to a mall, get a Starbucks coffee, and then read the book. You know, make it safe, that's fine. Okay, I'm finished picking on you. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Just one quick thing.
Yes, sir.
I was saying, when you're saying it's important to love yourself, and I was saying I processed a thing and I used it as a mantra, very love yourself, very love yourself. I went and looked at it last night, I was wrong. What I had said was very free yourself, very free yourself. And now that I think of it now, it's the same. It's like when I free myself, I love myself more. When I love myself more, I free myself more. So that's just...
That's very nice, Barry. That's very nice, thank you. The excellent path of the two accumulations. There are two things you have to accumulate in order to have the power to change your reactive behavior. At the moment, most of the behavior is reactive because it's based on self and trying to keep self safe. Self depends on who you think you are at any moment. I love that. You know, my mother used to say that. Who do you think you are? Wisdom, huh?
You all got that one.
It's a great saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are?
I never answered that one.
It's a good one. You need a lot of mileage out of that one.
He was beside himself with anger. I wasn't myself.
I don't know what got into me.
He has a good one too.
Because that's not me. Refuge, it says refuge. The two accumulations are what? What are the two accumulations?
Merit.
It's one. Merit and? Yeah, merit and wisdom. What can you tell me about the two accumulations?
Well, through good deeds you, or through good actions, you accumulate merit.
How do you accumulate wisdom?
I know this.
Well, it's different reading about it and actually taking it into yourself and thinking about it. See, you've all read a great deal, but you don't, somehow it doesn't have effect on you, does it? So what is it? Why do you buy a new book? You could just put a new cover on the old book and read it if you first started. Wouldn't it? I said I was going to stop picking on you, didn't I? Damn. Who's trustworthy after all? Not me. Merit and wisdom are the two accumulations. These are the two things that you need to accumulate in order to have the power to awaken, to be free, to be liberated from sufferings, from being subject to suffering, to be exact. These are two accumulations you need. You need to accumulate these two things. You need to accumulate merit because that stops you from being scattered, that stops you from lacking power, the lack of merit. Does that make sense? Do you understand that if you don't feel good about yourself, you're going to be continuously sabotaging everything you do? You've felt yourself do that, haven't you, at various times? All of you have at least that much insight, don't you, into your own psyches? You've seen that happening. You've seen people you love do that. So it kind of because of their lack of a sense of wholesomeness of themselves, that they don't have the power to do what they want to do. You know that? Okay. So that's the first one, is that merit is not different than power. And wisdom is not different from knowing how to use the power. I mean, there are times in my life where I'm very glad I did not have power, because I had no wisdom about how to use it. I remember one time when I had done a retreat and had done a great deal of work with a Tibetan deity called Vajrasattva. And I had many blessings from that retreat. One of the blessings was that Vajrasattva taught me how to heal the body, how to order the elements and heal the body. So I went around after that healing everybody left, right, and center. I'd wrestle people into a chair. Here, let me heal you! I just went, you know. And you know, here's some person that has spent lifetimes just perfecting this disease so they could just use this disease just right there to just find out what happened in this circumstance, and I'd come along and take it away. So they'd have to spend a few more lifetimes getting an even more deadly disease, you know. Because I was more impressed with what I could do . Have you ever done that? Mm-hmm. And to help somebody because you couldn't stand their pain, because you felt like you wanted to take their pain out of your face? Is that healing them or giving anesthetic to you? What do you think? Is that wisdom or is that addiction to your own pleasure? Wisdom is being able to see what is occurring without self, other. Wisdom is shunya. Wisdom is the clear understanding of no inherent self, no fixed identity. Not what I want, but what is happening. That's wisdom. So those are two accumulations. So wisdom comes from clear seeing and letting go of all your fixed views. This is right, no, this is right, no, this is right. Allowing a fixed view to arise and then allowing my sister's father to be born in Germany. No problem with that. And neither is a problem with my father being born in Poland. No problem with that either. Because there is an understanding of the cause and effect on which now this looks this way, now this looks that, and how they are both true, and there is no war. Does this make sense to you? Because if you don't do it that way, then your wisdom is not wisdom, it's judgment, and then you're living by rules, aren't you? When you're living with rules, are you peaceful? When you're not peaceful, do you have power? You have fear. So you have to be able to accumulate both. And both wisdom and merit. And they feed one another. Not just one. Both. So if you are going to take refuge, the first, if you're going to develop wisdom and merit, one of the best ways to do it is to take refuge. If you're going to take refuge, in what are you going to take refuge? What is it that you're going to take refuge? Yourself?
No.
Well, that'll be a shock to you. Isn't that your favorite refuge?
No.
You better send yourself a little note. Dear self, I would like to retire you from the duty of being my refuge.
Buddha nature.
Buddha nature, okay. Exactly. And how are you going to identify the Buddha nature in your being?
Well, the things that would turn your mind away from thinking of the yourself, the thing that I'm saying as a real defined self, the sort of the thoughts and ideas that turn your mind away from.
Yes, excellent. Excellent.
But can you also do it by just knowing that there is something that is, regardless, it's just always, it's really good, and then it's always good. And then it's
precisely. By naming a state that moves beyond self-cherishing. By naming a state that moves beyond self-cherishing, one takes refuge. By affirming, by naming, whatever you name it is less important than that you name it. That you consciously make a statement that you acknowledge that there is some aspect of your being that moves beyond self-referencing. That's a very important thing to do, to affirm that every day. Because Lord knows you often enough name the states that don't move beyond self-referencing. Isn't it true? So like once a day, just close to the beginning of your day, just sort of flip one up there. I name the state of awakening. That's what that means. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. I name the state of awakening. That's basically what it means. It's a little more complicated than that, but it's basically what it means. When we start meeting together and talking together, that's what I say. That's what you all say now. We are naming the state of awakening. That is the navigation goal. That is the star. That is the navigating key. With that named, then I will proceed. So this beautiful refuge prayer here says, the first line of it is, the void of impure dual perception. Second line, gives rise to lapis lazuli ground. Third line, blue and splendid, blessed with gold designs. the fourth line, a nectar lake ringed by trees and flowers. So what you do when you're naming the state of awakening, or you're naming the non-self-cherishing consciousness, is you're shifting the perception. Aren't you? You're shifting your perception from the habitual self-referencing perception to acknowledging that whether or not you can clearly see it, there is a strong belief in an aspect of consciousness that moves beyond self-referencing. And you're naming that. That's a very strong movement. So you're shifting your perception. In Buddhism, the number one key you have to changing your state of mind is change the sense of space. If you feel lonely and isolated, the best thing you can do right away is think, this is how I feel. I feel lonely. I feel isolated. And right now in this city, there must be at least 50 people who are also old men. Is he inside or outside?
Inside.
Is he alone or with others? Alone. This is an old man, alone, sitting inside. And he is feeling lonely. Just exactly this feeling. But he doesn't know he's not alone. At least I know I am sharing this with someone. And three blocks this way, there is somebody. Who is it? Male or female?
Hmm?
Woman. Is she young or old?
Young and beautiful.
Young and beautiful. Is she inside or outside?
Outside.
Outside. And she is feeling exactly the same feeling, three blocks that way. And there is someone like that, don't you think so?
Mm-hmm.
So you're allowing your consciousness to open beyond the I and experience other beings, other perceptions, right? And you do it in that direction, you do it in that direction. And you think, all these people, it's like tent pegs, you know? Make your tent a little bigger. The tent of your consciousness, spread it out. And you feel, all these people, all of us, we are feeling the same feeling. They don't know they're not alone, at least I know that. When I breathe in, I am breathing in the same feeling that they have. Breathe it in, and I'm sharing this feeling with them. And when I breathe out the awareness of the color blue. And I wish them to have a sense of whatever is blue in their room. And when I breathe in the same feeling. And when I breathe out the sense of the air on my cheek. I wish them to be aware of the air in the room moving. Right? You do three breaths like that, right? So what have you done there? You've used space. You've changed the space. You haven't changed anything else, but you have changed your perception of space. You haven't changed the emotion, you've changed your perception of space. So this begins, the void of impure dual perception gives rise to the void. That is to say, there is impure dual perception, and then when you really examine it, it's basically permeated by space. Impure dual perception is a perception, and it is operating in space. So you start working with the space, not the perception. Isn't that simple? Isn't it?
Hmm?
But what is it that says, yeah, but this is really true, this is what I see? It's that self-clinging, self-referencing. So whatever you see, when you're going to take refuge, the first thing you say is, whatever is here is also filled with space, and there are as many ways to perceive what is here as there are eyes who are perceiving it. How I am perceiving this space right now is not the same way that those little guys, little weird little animals that live on my eyelashes are perceiving this space right now. Or the dust mites in the corner, not to mention my sister. Is that true? There are as many ways of perceiving space as there can be beings who can report their perception. So you realize that right away. You understand that the impure dual perception is actually playing in space. So you focus on the space. So therefore, the void of the impure dual perception gives rise to. Out of that void, nature arises. And this is a set piece. This is a set piece. This is basically in... I have not seen it in Nyingma Buddhism, but that's because my education in Nyingma is probably not as advanced as the teaching I have had in the other schools. There is always this description of how to purify the place. The ground is... everywhere the ground is pure, free of hindrance and hazards. In nature, like lapis lazuli. In texture, like the palm of the hand. So that's the set piece to describe a particular realm which one can perceive if one is willing to change one's view, where the mind state is more easily able to go to refuge. You don't have to believe it, you just have to try it to see if it's true. This is a formula that has been passed on that says, if you wish to take refuge and you would like to do it with some strong sense of truth about it, try switching your perception and perceive the place that is a lapis lazuli ground, that its texture is like the palm of a hand, that's smooth and soft. So that if you step on it, it's got this smooth support, and then it holds you up and you bounce back again, you know, that kind of thing. Not bad, eh? I could sit there. Okay, the void of impure dual perception gives rise to lapis lazuli ground. That's what it's talking about. There is this, you know, really good lapis lazuli, that deep blue color. Very beautiful. And it has these gold swirls through it. Blue and splendid, blessed with gold design. The gold swirls are all the coming into beings and passings away, all the potential truths, all the possible ways outside of dual perception. If you do no longer see things as objects, you see them as activities. You look at someone, if you make them an enemy, you can say, I don't know why they did that. If you make them a friend, you understand why they did that. Oh, they did that because this, this, and that, and that happened. You understand the activity of their life. Does that make sense? If you look at them as an object, they don't have any activity. They're just stupid. Especially because they don't agree with you. But if you look at them as a friend, you start to understand why they don't agree with you. Isn't that true? So here, not only just the dual perception, but now everything is this lapis lazuli, rich blue ground, and all activity is this gold design, dancing of cause and effect, coming into being and passing away. And then from that, there arises a lake that is made of nectar. So this would be an exercise that you would do very quickly. Every morning, the void of impure dual perception gives rise to, lapis lazuli ground with gold design and a nectar lake. Okay. Kind of like Lake Louise, only better. Magic birds singing songs of Dharma. A rainbow canopy filled with scent. Divine blossoms falling like rain. So you image, what you do then is you pay attention to each sense door. And you image each sense door is picking up that kind of stimuli. And you watch how your energy changes when you do that. Because if you're going to understand reality, you'll need to know how your senses work. You image that there is this rainbow canopy above you and petals, rose petals, and all these different flowers are falling in space. Have you ever been outside in full moon when it was really heavily snowing, big fat snowflakes, and then the moon, the clouds part, and you can see dimensionally the snow falling? Can you imagine if those were like flower petals? And that you could smell them. Now that's a different sensation, isn't it? So if you actually worked with it this way and actually created the energy from your suggesting here. That would be whether it was as good as acid or all the hallucinogens or not. I don't know. But it works for me. This is a formula because it works. This is called how to change your mind. Change your oil, change your clothes, change your mind. Divine blossoms falling like rain adorn this pure realm of perfect form. So now you see you have imaged a God realm. They do exist. If you practice imaging that, it will strengthen your likelihood of having that experience so therefore it will be easier to let go of self-referencing. All of these are meant to help you transcend self-grasping. From wisdom springs a wish-granting tree. What does that mean? What does that mean?
When you've got the wisdom is the power to use the aspirations wisely.
No, the power is merit. Wisdom is what you need to use it.
Okay, so merit, then you got the merit, so your wishes are obviously meritorious. So the energy from the wishes you can make them unfold.
And partially true. What it's really saying is when there is no longer clinging to self, clinging to self-grasping and self-clinging, then it's really clear to see that this realm is a wish-fulfilling tree. Everything that is occurring is arising due to cause. Everything that is occurring is arising due to cause. Nothing arises without cause. Buddhist statement, absolute Buddhist statement. Nothing arises without cause. They say that this realm, the human realm, the symbol for it is the tree that has fruit, flower, and seed all at the same time. What does that mean? It means that whatever you ask for is going to happen. It might not happen when you want it to, it might come when you no longer want it. When I was 13 years old, my family could finally afford to give me a doll for Christmas. Unfortunately, I didn't want one. 6 years too late. I had really wanted one for 5 years. So I got it. Yeah? Wish-fulfilling tree. Any of you ever had that happen, that you get something when you no longer want it? How would you know? Because you've probably forgotten half the things you've wished for. When they land in your mailbox, you're saying, why did this come to me? Or calling it junk mail. Aren't you? So from wisdom, from the point of view of wisdom, one can see that whatever arises has cause. Or if you like the way that Chenrezig says it is, all activity is not different from Chenrezig, from compassion. Or if you like the way the Buddha said it, all beings will awaken. There is no being who is separate from awakening. It is even more of our career choice than senility. Some of us are taking a very wandering path. Like me, for example. And right, you know, 3 Buddhas ago, weren't you sitting behind me there? I know you didn't look the same, but... I didn't like his mustache. What about you? It's always something. So the wishes go round and round. Propensities, call them whatever you want to. Propensities, sankhara, wishes. This is the wish fulfiller. There is a wish fulfilling tree. And all the wishes are coming true. Just not wrapped the way you wanted them. When you wanted them. You're not who you were when you wanted them. So that's interesting, you know, from wisdom. Wisdom means non-self-referencing. From wisdom, from the point of view of wisdom, there is a wish-fulfilling tree. From wisdom springs a wish-fulfilling tree. Beautified by leaves, fruit, and flower. So the 3 stages, past, present, future. That operates, so the wish-fulfilling tree operates in time, in a relative world. Nothing arises without cause. You understand that symbolism? Mm-hmm. That fulfills one's wishes at a thought. Just think of some of your thoughts. They're coming. They're coming. On that tree rests a many-hued lotus, multicolored lotus. Why a lotus? What does a lotus represent?
Pure.
Purity. Why does it represent purity?
Well, I think it's because the blueness and the dirt falls out. There's some sort of process where the dirt doesn't stick to the blue when it comes up. It grows from dirt and mud up through water.
Because it grows clean. From the mud. It comes right up through the mud, through the muddy water. Pulled only by light, gets swayed by this decision, that impulse, sways around a lot, but keeps going up, comes above the water, and then opens brilliantly, beautifully white or clear-colored flower above the surface. So from the mud comes a transcendental understanding. That's the basis. From the mud, from the difficulty, comes transcendence. From suffering comes wisdom. So this Holiness the Dalai Lama says that you should greet difficulties as your teacher.
Is it the same thing then to say that no suffering, no wisdom?
I have never heard no suffering, no wisdom, but I know that Marpa said to Milarepa, it's too bad you didn't suffer more, you would have been a better teacher. So is that the sort of thing you're referring to?
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
Wisdom is no inherent self.
But if there's no suffering, then there's no ability to actually apprehend that.
No suffering, no enlightenment. I've heard that. But I've never heard no suffering, no wisdom. But I'm, you know, so I don't know what that would mean. Do you have some idea what that would mean that you can tell me?
If there is no, the first noble truth that there is suffering. If there is not suffering, then everything else just cannot happen. The truth of the state of suffering is the cause that, is the first cause that has to, the first thing that has to happen. One has to actually know that one is suffering.
That there is suffering.
Yeah.
Not that one is suffering. That there is. There's a difference. A big difference. There is dissatisfaction. Can you say that?
Yes, there is dissatisfaction.
You know, you can have a headache, but you don't have to. It isn't I am suffering. I am experiencing a headache, and the suffering is a choice or not, isn't it? To some degree. A greater degree than one might like to think. So there is suffering. There is cause for suffering, there is cessation of suffering, and there is a way to the cessation of suffering. There's something that can be done. Those are the Four Noble Truths. The First Noble Truth is not, does not address the First Noble Truth is solved when there is no longer a self who can suffer. There is still suffering. I've said another occasion the Buddha said there is suffering but no one suffering. There is a headache but no one suffering. There is dissatisfactoriness. But there is no one caught in it because there is no inherent self. It's not the suffering that goes away. It's the self. The self has always gone away, but one does not acknowledge it. So wisdom is always there. Wisdom is no inherent self. Wisdom is shunya. The definition of wisdom is no inherent self. Wisdom is always present, but whether it is conscious or not is the question. Are you following this? Is this interesting to you?
Yes.
Okay.
So, the consciousness...
It's almost like the negative of it for us. Usually we think of it, well, I have to, but it's like the negative of that. It's like, you know, the...
Those pictures.
The photograph.
Yes,
yeah.
When you're looking at the white or the dark.
Yeah, but we're looking at the wrong thing to remove. You don't have to do anything about the suffering. It's impermanent anyway. It's moving. Isn't it? Jesus is going to move so well that this body is just going to disappear. There won't be any suffering for I then at all. That's not a question, you know?
So
like, death should teach us that. Impermanence is real.
So then is it a crapshoot that the consciousness of this awareness just arises or not?
Not specifically so. It's based on clinging. It's based on ignorance. The number one thing is there is ignorance. That is ignoring. Ignoring what?
That's real.
Yeah. Going for primitive views or conflicting emotional states. Those are the two veils that obscure reality. That's the teaching. Ignoring what is because of how you I feel.
I just feel this way about it.
It feels like the right thing to do. Has anybody in this room ever said that?
No.
or but this is how I know it's true. This is true. No, you really did dip that in the huh? No, I really didn't dip that in the partial view. Maybe you dipped it with your mind. Maybe I dipped it with your mind. Right? Mm-hmm. Is that confusing enough? Good. Okay. On it rests a many-hued lotus. So the lotus arises out of the mud, basically, right? Some of you have never heard this before. Is that true? You've never heard this before, have you, Kathy? Have you heard this before, Otto?
Yeah.
How about you? Yeah. So how come you were the only one that knew what a lotus was? It's amazing, isn't it? I think it's wonderful. A precious throne. Shall I do this with every image, or should I just keep going? The sun and moon discs. There sits the Lord of all, Vajradhara. That's Vajradhara up there, the blue guy. Vajradhara represents the mind, body of a fully awakened being, a Buddha, after he dies. Well, before he dies or after he dies, no difference, really, for a Buddha. But that's what that represents. totality, consciousness. This is Lords of All, Vajradhara, who is all Buddhas and Gurus in one. He is not separate from all Buddhas at all time, all space. That is the experience of full awakening. That is not separate from all Buddhas and all teachers. You could even say all beings if you consider the Buddha nature of all beings. He is blue with one face, his two hands crossed at his heart hold vajra and bell, clad in bone ornaments and fine silks. His blue-black locks are heaped on his crown and hang in tresses, his legs are crossed. So for the idea of the bodhicitta, of the awakening power, you use a figure that represents that power that has existed for all beings in all times and all spaces. And you visualize. Smiling joyously, he faces me, and then you make it personal. He is smiling joyously, and I and he. Around him are all the lineage gurus, so that can be actual lineage gurus, or it can be all the beings that you have ever felt were teachers for you, that taught you something. It doesn't matter. It's all one continuous chain. It's all that one energy, that there is some energy in the universe that speaks directly to your heart about how to transcend suffering. And that you know that path, you know it more deeply and more firmly than you ever allow yourself to manifest in the world. That doesn't mean you don't know it. And so you're affirming, yes, I know this path. And that is what I take refuge in. On the front petal are the yidam, so this is a classical Tibetan refuge. So there is the Vajradhara in the middle, representing that personal connection with the mind of awakening within your own being. On the front are the yidam, so that's kind of your interests. Are you a professional pool player? You're a professional 5-year-old, are you a professional talker, are you a professional photographer, you know? What you are particularly, do you like desire, do you like words, do you like compassion, do you like activity? Your particular path, there are 5 main types of paths, and they all have, each of them has many sub-rules, and so that's called the yidams. On the right petal, all the Buddhas, behind the scriptures, though, all of the teachings. To the left, all of the beings who are the community that is actively moving, consciously moving toward awakening. Gurus, Yidams, Buddhas, Shravakas, Bodhisattvas, Pracheka Buddhas, Viras, Dakinis, Guardians, Wealth Gods, worthy refuge objects, fill the sky. So this isn't a bad place to go for a holiday. And the price is right. You could just do this in the privacy of your own room with a cup of coffee there if you want, doesn't matter. You could just go through this and visualize this. And practice teaching yourself not to believe so strongly in your habitual I. What?
I was just thinking back when I first encountered this. And I did not like it at all.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
It's funny, isn't it?
But it was just too weird.
Very weird. And something very beautiful. My parents and I sit before them. Your mother on your left, your father on your right. Doesn't matter if they're dead or not. So on the one hand, you have the guru and all the Buddhas. And all the gurus that have been, guru is Vajradhara, and all the gurus that have ever been. So you got all that DNA story, all that personal history, all those case histories of all that consciousness arranged before you. And on this hand, you have yourself and your mother and your father and your mother's parents and your father's parents and your mother's parents' parents and your father's parents and your children, male, female usually. And anybody who has the great bad taste to dislike you in front of you, right in front of you, they're first. They obviously need it most. What we call your enemies in front of you, or people you have difficulties with anyway. Somebody stalking you, put them right in front of you. So what you have got, and anything you possess, anything you own that you would like to use for Dharma, like if you decide you're going to drive down to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama when he's in Portland in May, and your car isn't doing good, then you image your car beneath you, and your aspiration that is going to be a vehicle for you that's supporting you in Dharma. Understand this? So you're working with all of the possible DNA stories that are all present in your being. I'm using the word DNA because I don't know how else to describe that. All of the messages passed to you from generations. Not just the ones that you habitually chose because of whoever made you and because of the conditions that were present when you were born in 1939 or 1949 or 1959. But you're saying not only the personal story that I keep liking to have, but also all the potentiality. I open my consciousness to all the potentiality, and I train that forward to all the possibility. Now that's not a bad idea for the morning, is it? That would blow a hole in loneliness. This is a big family. My parents and I sit before them with those from six realms in human form. So the six realms are?
Animal, ghost.
Hungry
ghost.
Yeah, we got six a couple of times over there. all take refuge. We forgot Ashura, so didn't we? All take refuge until enlightenment. With complete devotion, hope, and faith. And then you repeat that. Refuge taker in the Guru and the Holy Masters, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Namo Guru Be, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sangha, Namo Guru Be, Buddhaya. Over and over again, focusing on each one until you have a real connection. The text says, until your hair rises, or else until tears start in your eyes. That's how many people say that. Until you really actually know that that's true. That is true. That is what you're interested in. That is your navigation star. Or until you decide it's too late, you've got to go to work. But hopefully when it's true. And then when you finish doing that, you sit there and you say that as many, many times as you want to. You can say that 100,000 times. You can say it once. I recommend many repetitions of it. There are lots of ways to say it. I like Namo Guru Be, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya. It's a nice short form, but you can do longer ones too. You can do it in any language you want. And then you say, in the Guru and the three precious gems, I bow down and take refuge. Bless my mind continuum. Bless this mind continuum. Bless this movement of energy that it moved toward liberation. That's reasonable. That's a reasonable request. And then you say, Peerless Guru and Triple Gem, to you I bow down and take refuge. Bless my body, voice, and mind, and those of each and every being. Bless my mind to turn to Dharma. Bless me to reach the path of Dharma. Sweep away delusions on the path, and may delusions dawn as wisdom. Bless me that irreligious thoughts cease. Bless me that love and compassion grow. May I practice the two bodhicittas, relative truth and absolute truth. May I practice both relative and absolute. And may I reach Buddhahood swiftly. And then while visualizing, light shines from the refuge objects, lifting the two veils, which are primitive you and conflicting emotion. Lifting them, perfecting the two heaps, which are the accumulation of wisdom and the accumulation of merit. Beings' minds now Dharmakaya, now the same, the body of truth. Like their bodies become rainbow light. They leave for divine realms. It's a good meditation to practice rebirth. The refuge dissolves into light, fills the guru, who dissolves into light, at his heart a ball of blue light, which enters my crown, blessing my mind stream. You hold that energy of blue light in your heart. Enters the crown, sinks down to the heart. And then you say, consider that the clarity of the mind is the Sangha. Clarity of mind is the Sangha. Clarity is that discriminating wisdom, the ability to see detail, to see cause and effect. That is Sangha. Sangha is the cause and effect, the activity. That is Sangha.
I'm sorry. Sangha is cause and effect. I thought...
It says the clarity, consider that the clarity of the mind is the Sangha. Clarity means being able to see things as they are, to see cause and effect, to see the energy dancing, to see the gold lines in the lapis lazuli, to see not an object, but the entire cause and effect of why my father was born in Germany or Poland or South Africa, or and all the possible cause and effect, all the ancestors. That's the Sangha, to see that, what do you want to call it? Do you want to call it interdependent origination? That would be a good thing to call it. As a matter of fact, that's what the Buddha called it. Dependent origination. That's Sangha. And that's called clarity of mind. To no longer see subject-object, but to see the dancing energy coming into being, existing, and passing away, called interdependent origination. That's Sangha. That's the first line. The empty aspect is the holy Dharma, void nature, void of what? Inherent what? Identity. Void of fixed self. Void of inherent identity. No phenomena or identity. The voidness. So from one hand, the dancing energy. From another facet, you look at it, void nature. See dancing energy? See void nature. Those two together are Buddha. Void nature is Dharma. The clarity of mind is Sangha. Void nature is Dharma. Those two together are Buddha. All three manifest is Guru. Okay? And the consider that the clarity of the mind is the Sangha, the empty aspect is the holy Dharma, the combination of the two is the Buddha, its nature, which is the non-differentiation of the three, is the Guru. For as long as possible, meditate on this. And then say, by this virtue may all beings perfect wisdom and merit and wisdom and gain the two holy forms that rise from this perfection. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. 5 minutes over time. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints about refuge?
Could you say those last two lines?
The sharing of merit?
You closed it and you were still singing the last two lines.
Okay, yeah. By this virtue may all beings perfect merit and wisdom and gain the two holy forms that rise from this perfection. The two holy forms are Dharmakaya and Nirmanakaya, form body and truth body. Form body has two kinds, energy or manifestation. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
When you were speaking, it was something that Otto had brought up, and you said there are five paths, five... I got a sense of one of them was devotion, but and that's all I can recall. Five different ways of...
Three downs?
Yeah.
I wasn't going to tell her that because she said auto, so I was, because that could take half an hour. Maybe we can talk about that tomorrow. Because it's 5 minutes after union time, but I'm still kind and compassionate and willing to take any short questions.
I was excited. Is merit and merit and compassion, are those two interchangeable? So you could say compassion and wisdom,
not per se. Merit is basically starts very simply by learning to love yourself. You learn to love yourself by stopping doing things that make you paranoid, make you feel everybody's out to get you, make you frustrated. Right? That's the first thing you do, is you stop mugging old ladies, for example. Because that makes you feel paranoid. You know, you stop attacking other people because that makes you feel bad. You stop doing something that makes you feel guilty. Then you like yourself more. Now, there are lots of ways to stop it. If it's something that you shouldn't make you feel guilty, stop feeling guilty about it. By making it an offering to a Buddha or something. Clean it up. Right? So that's merit. That's start by loving yourself. And then, what was your question?
I heard compassion and wisdom used as being the two sort of roots for.
Yeah, because when you develop merit, it's like it becomes love, self-love first, and then it spreads out. It becomes love for all beings because they're not separate from self, and then finally it becomes fearlessness, and then it transforms from love into compassion. So then compassion and wisdom go hand in hand. Compassion is being able to discriminate. Love doesn't discriminate. So it spreads and spreads and spreads. It becomes boundless, and then compassion. Then when fearlessness enters, then you also start having compassion.
If merit along the line goes to compassion, does wisdom transform in any way?
Merit doesn't. So merit mostly goes to love. Is basically an ability to love, and when their love is boundless, then you start developing skill, and so that's called compassion. Compassion is active. Love is boundless. It doesn't make any discrimination. It's unconditional. Compassion. So it's like, here's the difference. If somebody is in a traffic accident and they're lying there on the sidewalk, they're bleeding to death, someone can come along and sit beside them, and this extreme love of everything about the circumstance will sit there, and this person will just be in this, washed in this bathe of love. Compassion will say, excuse me, this is a tourniquet, get out of the way. It's like, okay, yeah, this is love, and this is wonderful. And in this case, in order for this to move further, this is what we apply. So they're quite different. Love is unconditioned, has no conditioning, no conditions whatsoever. It moves through all boundaries, does not discriminate. Compassion discriminates. So compassion has to do with that mind that can see the cause and effect. So compassion. You had a question?
No, just the compassion is a skillful action.
Skill,
yeah. Skill, yeah.
Requires naming. Do you have a question, or can I?
Yeah, just one thing that you said, that wisdom is always there, whether you're conscious of it or not.
So wisdom is always present, because there is no inherent self. So as the Buddha said, it isn't that you have to awaken. If you have to, you just have to awaken to the fact that you're awakened.
So there's always,
you don't have to add anything, you have to become aware. The whole of the path is awareness.
So as my Buddha nature says, do this, it'll make you happy, and don't do this, it'll make you suffer. But it's my delusion and my desire and my ignorance that says, well, ignore that. You know, I want to seek pleasure and avoid pain. Does that make sense?
I have, for 9 years, I had these wonderful meditation teachers, all of whom told me, by the way, do leave your eyes open when you meditate. And for 9 years I said, oh yes, thank you for your meditation instruction, now I'm going to meditate. Took me 9 years. Not one of my teachers told me to close my eyes. For 9 years, I said, thank you very much for your instruction, bowed, paid my respects, went off and closed my eyes. So, then when I open my eyes, I open my eyes. One moment of the candle lit, and billions of years of darkness is dispelled. It isn't a matter of how long or who or what or where. When you actually decide you want to see what happens by following somebody's instruction, you do it. And the moment you do that, the darkness is dispelled. It doesn't matter how many thousands of years there's been darkness. There is no beginning to samsara. There's no way to count the number of years that you and I have been totally stupid assholes. The question is it time to open our eyes? What do you think? I'll open one eye. I'm stubborn. How about you? Sometimes? And who is it that loses the view when my eyes are closed? My teachers? I don't think so. It wasn't them that didn't understand what was happening when you open your eyes and close your eyes. And who is it that has problems with praise and blame if they substitute rules for morality? Rules are not morality. The first thing you have to do is feel good about yourself. So, repentance, confession, forgiveness. Those are three really good tools. Anything to give you a new view? Huh? Have I gone blah, blah, blah enough? That's enough blah, blah, blah for tonight. You notice this extremely beautiful, and of course you're not going to close your eyes, because you know if you do, I'll come and bite you. This extremely beautiful gold light is in... Oh, there's that Terry Flanner with his eyes closed right now. I'm going to stroke him. Did you see that?
Today I have more.
Yeah, right now? There you go. I'm slipping into the past again.
Yeah,
it's very beautiful gold light is in your heart, and it just spreads through your body. This light, this warm light, it's like, you know, Tasmanian honey is what it's like. It just spreads through every cell of your body, up through your head, down through your legs and eyes, pours out your pores in every direction, just fills this room. Just this house, it subverts this neighborhood with sweetness. This goes right through the whole of Edmonton. There's Stockwell Day, got it again. Just give it to them. Just let it pour. All the people who are in hospitals, all the leaders and politicians, everywhere through this world, all the animals, all beings everywhere. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, this light just washes that for that moment. There is just this openness. And you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering, etc. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.